Well, good morning. There we go. I guess, hope I wasn't on the whole time we were singing. But anyway, when I was in, I don't know, maybe 8th or 9th grade, I saw a movie on TV that really fascinated me and really stuck with me for a long time. And what it was is it was a movie that chronicled the life of Howard Hughes. Now, for those of you in the room older than me, you're probably pretty familiar with a lot of his story. For those of you younger than me, about half and half both ways, you might not be as familiar with his story. So let me fill you in a little bit on it, because I think it sets the stage for this morning's parable very well. In the late 1960s, Howard Hughes was the world's richest man. He was the Donald Trump of the 1960s. He was a pilot, a businessman, and when he died, he left an estate valued at $2.3 billion. In his prime, Hughes was the archetypical American hero. He was a daring aviator and a relentless tinkerer who spurred science to new horizons. He owned one of the most crucial defense firms in the U.S., Hughes Aircraft, a flag-carrying airline, TWA, and a myriad of companies whose prosperity guaranteed the welfare of dozens of communities. And he even exercised great influence on the highest levels of government. Yet amazingly, he died like a street bum hooked on drugs and manipulated by those who were his supposedly most trusted aides. In his final years, he lived in the top floor of a hotel in Las Vegas in a 15 by 17 foot room with the windows completely blackened in. And he had stacks of newspapers and magazines covering most of the available space. In his last 4 years of living in the Desert Inn in Las Vegas, his own guards stationed right outside his door never saw him, because he did not leave the room. He was holed up in his own prison because he was afraid that somebody was out to get him. He lived for 2 years on a diet of nothing but two cans of Campbell's chicken soup that he would personally open himself so that he'd know that he wasn't being poisoned. Because of his fear without being seen, he went 4 years without even having his room vacuumed, dusted, or cleaned. He spent the last years of his life lying in bed in a dark room, watching movies, eating soup, and taking drugs to numb his physical and emotional pain. Listen to a description of his body just before his death. Quote, "His body was starved, dehydrated, and atrophied to a pitiful skeleton resembling the victims of Dachau and Buchenwald. He weighed barely 90 pounds. His one-time 6-foot-4-inch frame had shrunk 3 inches. His legs and arms were pipe-thin, thin, so fragile that a strong child might have snapped them like a wishbone. On his back were 2 severe bed sores that had plagued him for years. His pelvis jutted sharply, uncushioned by flesh. On his right side, you could see the outline of a medical surgical pin that had repaired, after a fashion, the hip bone he had snapped more than 2 hours earlier in a fall. The world's richest man died in this hotel room of kidney failure. And here's one of the great ironies. He died of kidney failure because when he needed dialysis, they could not find a dialysis machine available. But get this, it was in one of his hospitals that the dialysis machine was created, invented, and first put to use. At his death, the world was shocked at his condition, but it barely noticed his absence. The Las Vegas casinos, however, did observe a moment of silence. And this last quote kills me. It says, "For a brief moment, the casinos fell silent. Housewives stood uncomfortably clutching their paper cups full of coins at the slot machines. The blackjack games paused, and at the crap tables, the stickmen cradled the dice in the crooks of their wooden wands. Then a pit boss looked at his watch and whispered, "Okay, roll the dice. He's had his minute." All the wealth and power that the world has to offer, and he got 1 minute. You see, the life of Howard Hughes is a prime example of the story that Jesus tells in Luke chapter 12, verses 13 through 21. So let me read that for you. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbitrator between you?" Then he said to them, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." And so he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." Then he said, "This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, 'You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded of you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?' This is how it will be for anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich towards God." Okay, let's backtrack now and go through the story in a little more detail. First of all, notice the setting that Luke gives us for the story. It begins with a man's demand for his rights. Look at verse 13. It says, "Someone in the crowd said to him, 'Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me.'" What you need to understand here is that in Jesus' day, the people expected the rabbis to be knowledgeable in the law and capable of pronouncing judgment on matters such as this. So this really isn't that unusual of a setting. This man comes up, he's got a dispute with his brother. Jesus is a rabbi he's a traveling rabbi with disciples. So he says, "Okay, Jesus, decide this dispute with me and my brother." But notice that the man doesn't ask Jesus to make a judgment about what is right. Notice that he demands that Jesus agree with him and make his brother do what he believes is right. To say, "Rabbi, my brother and I are quarreling over our inheritance, will you mediate?" is one thing. But to say, "Tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me," is quite another. In other words, the man says, "My rights are being violated. Jesus, you're a rabbi. Tell my brother to quit violating my rights and give me what I deserve." But notice Jesus' response. Notice that Jesus refuses to divide. Look at verse 14. Jesus replied, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbitrator between you?" What you need to understand here is that it was common in Jesus' day for a father to leave his land to his sons without dividing it in his will. Now, fathers did this very intentionally. They did it in part because of the great value they placed on the land. The land was given to them from generation to generation. And so the land was almost seen as holy. But the other part of it is that it was a father's desire that the sons can work together on the land. That they can be partners, that they can be life companions together. So many times the father would leave the land in the will, just dedicated that this land goes to my sons, and not declare any boundaries, not declare any division, in the hopes that the sons could join together in partnership and share the land. But you see, this man came to Jesus and said, "My brother and I cannot work together. I won't work with him. Make him divide the land." Well, question, why does the brother refuse to divide the land? It most likely conclusion is that the other brother wishes to obey the father's wishes. The most likely conclusion is that the other brother is not ready to sever the relationship. You see, this man that comes to Jesus doesn't just ask for what is rightly his. He asks Jesus to be the one who signs the divorce papers. His cry appears to be one of give me what is rightfully mine, but it means much more than that. It means ending the relationship between two brothers. When Jesus says, who appointed me a judge, he is saying, look, I've not come as one who divides, but as one who unites. But notice that Jesus isn't content to stop there, but that he digs a little deeper. He isn't content to just address the presenting problem. He goes after the root of the problem. He goes after the core issue in verse 15. Notice what he says. He says, then he said to them, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Jesus says, look, the real root behind all this is the issue of greed. He says, be on the watch against all kinds of greed. Now, the word that the NIV translates here is greed. It's translated in other versions by covetousness. But literally what it means is the desire to have more. And certainly it applies to material things and wealth, but it can apply, I think, to anything in our lives. That's why it says all kinds of greed. Anything that we just have to have more. I've got to have more. No matter how much we get, it's not enough. It's insatiable. And it becomes a controlling factor. And so Jesus says, be aware of all kinds of greed. It is a fundamental warning against striving for the increase of material possessions as a means of security. In other words, the man says, you know, divide this inheritance, I'll have my land, and then my life will be set, and everything will be under control. But Jesus says, no, a man's life does not consist of the abundance of possessions. Jesus is telling the man, look, the relationship you have with your brother is far more important than the land you are fighting over. After all, what is land compared to a brother? What is land compared to the relationship you are throwing away? Even if your brother gives you your share of the land, your problem will not be solved. You may have the land and you may have possessions, but you will still be alone and your heart will still be far from God. And then to bring the point home, Jesus tells the parable, starting in verse 16. And the parable begins with God's blessing. Look at verse 16. And he told them this parable. The ground of a certain rich man produced a crop. Okay, notice what Jesus didn't say. He didn't say a certain rich man worked his ground diligently and was rewarded with a great crop. No, he said the ground of a certain rich man produced a crop. In other words, he says God did it. This abundant crop, this abundant gift that you have is a blessing from God and not the result of your effort. Obviously, the rich man hasn't caught that yet. Because notice the man's dilemma in verse 17. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Excuse me, I hate allergy season. May ought to just be outlawed. Last of May, 1st of June, just ought to be wiped off the map, skip all the grasses coming out, and life would be much better for me. But notice the man's dilemma. Instead of seeing this great blessing from God, he almost sees it as a burden. He looks at this great blessing and he says, you know, I have no place to put all the stuff. My barns are still full from last year's crop. What in the world am I going to do with all of this? But notice, however, that he makes no acknowledgement of the fact that the good crop is a gift from God. Notice his emphasis. He says, I have no place to store my crops. In fact, throughout the story, notice the man's emphasis on the words my and I. Especially as we look at the man's plan in verse 18 and 19. It says, then he said, this is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods, and I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. Again, notice the emphasis on I and my. My crops, my barns. I will do this. I will do that. Remember, this crop doesn't make him a rich man. It makes him a richer man. He doesn't need this crop to pay his bills and provide a roof over his head. No, it is a gift of surplus. But think about it. Isn't his plan the American dream? Strike it rich, retire young, take life easy. I mean, be honest a minute. Before we burn this man at the stake, let's honestly answer the question, who of us can say we haven't dreamed of being in his position? I mean, how many of you have ever seen a publisher's clearinghouse sweepstakes? Or how many of you have ever, and I say you here, how many of you here have ever bought a lottery ticket? Okay, I say you because I never have. Never bought a lottery ticket, never put a coin in a slot machine. And before I'm tempted to brag about that and take that as some point of spiritual pride, as I was working through this week, I thought of something that I have done that is just as ridiculous. And you can probably relate to it. I can't tell you how many times, you know, every year when McDonald's does their Monopoly game, I can't tell you how many times I have gone to McDonald's and all I'm going to get is just a sandwich. And then I see, oh, they got that Monopoly game going. And if you supersize, then you get double tickets. So guess what I do? I supersize and I didn't even want the fries in the first place. Why? Because I might strike it rich. Do you realize that the man's plan in this story is the driving force behind state lotteries and all gambling in general? One big payoff and I can retire. Life will be good. I will have security and everything will be wonderful. I'll buy a nice house, a new car, and have enough money in the bank that I can just live off the interest the rest of my life. I can go where I want, do what I want, when I want. Oh, wouldn't life be grand? You see, the rich man in this story, like many of us, believes that the total needs of a person can be met by material surpluses well preserved for the owner's exclusive use. We'll look at God's judgment, and it comes in a twofold way. The first part of God's judgment is in the first part of verse 20, where he says, your loan is due. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. The term Jesus uses when he says your life will be demanded from you is a technical term that is commonly used to describe the repayment of a loan. It's an accounting term. You have a debt and the banker has called it due. You must pay it full today. In essence, Jesus is saying, you fool, don't you know that everything you have is on loan from God? And tonight he is going to call that loan due. Are you ready to pay up? Don't you realize that they aren't your crops and your life and your barns, but those are my crops. Those are God's crop. That is God's gift. And now God is saying, this very night, your life and everything I have given you, I want paid back. But then notice the second part of the judgment. Is not only is your loan due, but your life is wasted. Look at the rest of verse 20. He says, then, when your life is demanded of you this very night, then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? He says, look, your life is wasted. In fact, notice going back to the man's dialogue. Notice that it was all about himself. Notice the isolation in the dialogue. In fact, let me back up to that. This man said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my house and build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of good things laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. Notice that he never says we. Notice that there is never an our. Do you think that's just an accidental omission? I don't think so. I think Jesus did it very intentionally. Because here is a man who has consumed his life around what he could possess for himself. And what happens when you consume your life around what you can obtain for yourself? Your circle becomes increasingly smaller and smaller and more isolated. You see, I think that when Jesus has the man speak to himself, notice he doesn't tell anybody else this. He says, and the man said to himself. He didn't say this man said to his wife and his children and the family and friends around him. He said, and the man said to himself. And I think what that means is that this man has worked so hard to build bigger and better barns and hoard his blessings that he has missed the whole point of life. And now he's living it all by himself. Jesus says in Mark 12 that the two most important things in life are to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. The two most important things in life, loving God and loving neighbors. And yet what has been obviously the most important thing in this man's life? The accumulation of wealth. But think about it. This man is the stereotypical American father who has spent all his time and energy at work, quote, earning a good living for his wife and kids, who he never knew because he was gone all the time. It's the typical story of countless individuals who have spent their whole life on the gerbil wheel, chasing the carrot of money and material possessions, and lived their life alone. Oh, they might be married, they might have a big family, but they're alone because all their energy is focused on obtaining more. Well, what does God say? He says tonight, not tomorrow, not next week, not next year, but tonight your life will be demanded from you. Your very life, I'm going to call it due, and it will be over. And so notice the conclusion in verse 21. Jesus says, this is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself, but is not rich towards God. Jesus says, if you live your life like the rich fool, you will end up living a life void of relationships and unable to enjoy the very things you've accumulated. I mean, that's part of the, you know, that's part of the ludicrousy of it. So what if you work 80 hours a week to have all these nice things? How much time do you have to enjoy them? None. So what if you drive the nicest car? If all you do is drive it from home to work. This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich toward God. If you live your life like the rich fool, you will end your life void of relationships. And brothers and sisters in Christ, this isn't just an ancient story. It's been repeated in every generation, in every community. This is Howard's End. Not the movie, but the real life story of every individual who fails to heed Jesus' warning. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. Howard Hughes is probably the prime example of that. I mean, it blows my mind away to think of this man shriveling up and dying all by himself because he was so convinced that anybody who tried to get close to him, guess why they wanted to be close to him? To get their hands in his pockets. And you know what? Very likely it was true. I don't know if those of you that remember that when he died, there was, in fact, I don't even know if the court cases have ever been solved over his will. People came out of the woodwork. There were handwritten wills coming from everywhere. Why? Because everybody who had ever been connected with him wanted to get a piece of his finances. And yet he died as an old man, and not even that old of a man, but as a man holed up by himself, dying for someone who would love him for who he was and not for what he had. And folks, that's what Jesus says here. This is how it will be for anyone who stores up things for himself rather than being rich toward God. Well, what does it say to you and I? Well, let's spend a little time applying it. Because I think we all wrestle with this. And I'll be honest with you, this was a difficult one for me this week. This week we were just struggling with some of our finances and just kind of being at the end of the rope, you know, being kind of on the edge looking over like, what's down there? And so to come in, and as I'm writing this sermon, I'm like, in fact, there was one point where I just kind of set everything down, went over my couch and just prayed for a while, because it was like, God, you know, this is my struggle. Because, you know, you don't have to be rich to be in Howard Hughes' place. You can be poor and still be driven by greed. You can be flat broke and still be chasing on that gerbil wheel after the illusion of, if I can only have this, life will be good. So let me give you some applications that have been meaningful to me this week. The first one is that you cannot find wealth, you cannot find life in the monetary realm or the material realm. You cannot find life in the material realm. Life cannot be found in what we own or possess. It is an endless chasing after the wind. If you seek life from what you have, there will always be something missing. No matter how much you make, no matter how much you own, Satan will constantly dangle a new carrot in front of you and keep you spinning the wheel. You know, it's the age-old thing of trying to keep up with the Joneses across the street. What always happens whenever you catch up to them? Well, they go buy a new car. Or they move to the next block where the houses cost more. There's never a keeping up. There is always somebody ahead of us. There's always someone who has more. And that's why many of us, most of us, are broke in a land of plenty. That's why it doesn't really matter how much we make. It's all spent. And yet Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And yet we spend our energy chasing after more of this and more of that, as if when we have more of that, life will be good. And you know, Debbie and I were talking this week about, I think one of the places where this hits us the hardest sometimes is with our kids. Is because we think, well, if I could just had the money to pay for this lesson or this activity or this toy or this whatever, then their life will be good. But again, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. We will only find true life in Him and not in His gifts or His provisions. He is the only security. He is the only soul satisfaction. And we must repent of our seeking life from what we have or what we do not have. You cannot find life in the material realm. But then secondly, before I move on to that, look at what Jesus says as the story continues in Luke. It says, then Jesus said to his disciples, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or about your body, what you will wear. Life is more than food, and the body more than clothes. Consider the ravens. They do not sow or reap. They have no storeroom or barn, yet God feeds them. And how much more valuable are you than they? I mean, how indicting is that passage? How many times do we lay awake at night wondering how we're going to have the funds for whatever we're trying to do? And yet Jesus says, don't worry about your life. Why? Because life is more than food and clothes. Life is me. And besides all that, consider the ravens. They don't labor or toil. They have no storeroom to keep all their goods. And yet, do they go hungry? No. Why? Because my heavenly Father feeds them. And you and I are in the same place. We're in a place where we need to step back and say, ask the question, am I pursuing bigger barns? Am I taking the gifts that God has given me and said, but I got to have more? Am I pursuing this illusion of a dream that says, if I make it to this point, if I get this X amount in my retirement account, if I get X amount per year, then life will be good? The reality is no. Life will not be good. It will only be good when Jesus Christ is in the center of everything. But then secondly, not only can you not find life in the material realm, we need to realize that Jesus is the Lord of unity and not division. Do you realize that Jesus cares much more about the quality of our relationships than whether or not we get our rights? I think that's why Jesus was so affronted by this man. This man came to Jesus and said, Jesus, settle this between my brother and I and make him divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus says, you want me to be the one who cuts the knife between you and your brother? Do you have any clue who I am? You see, Jesus would much rather you or I be wronged financially, have our rights infringed, than see us destroy a relationship. Why? Because Jesus knows that people are always more important than things. Jesus knows that when we demand our rights, we sink into selfishness and we sink into isolation. Because whenever we sink into selfishness, we create a world of our own. And whenever we do that, ultimately we die. Maybe not physically, not right away. But spiritually we die. Relationally we die. We were created to need one another. And yet how many times in our lives are relationships endangered because of material things? Jesus says, look, it's not about the things. It's about the relationships. Kenneth Bailey, or let me backtrack one more thing. I think part of what he's saying here is that whenever you are in conflict with someone over material things, don't ask God to give you what is right. Ask God to restore the relationship. Kenneth Bailey wrote a poem that expresses the exact opposite of the story of the rich fool. Listen to a part of what he wrote. He said, a certain man had two sons. One was rich and the other was poor. The rich son had no children, while the poor son was blessed with many sons and many daughters. In time, the father fell ill. He was sure he would not make it through the week. So on Saturday, he called his sons to his side and gave each of them half of the land and the inheritance. Then he died. Before sundown, the sons buried their father with respect as custom requires. That night, the rich son could not sleep. He said to himself, what my father did was not just. I am rich, my brother is poor. I have bread enough to spare while my brother's children eat one day and trust God for the next. I must go move the landmark which our father has set in the middle of the land so that my brother will have the greater share. But he must not see me. If he sees me, he will be ashamed. I must arise early in the morning and move the landmark. With this, he fell asleep, and his sleep was secure and peaceful. Meanwhile, the poor brother also could not sleep. And as he lay restless in his bed, he said to himself, what my father did was not just. Here I am surrounded by the joy of many sons and daughters, while my brother daily faces the shame of having no sons to carry on his name and no daughters to comfort him in his old age. He should have the land of our fathers. Perhaps this will in part compensate him for his indescribable poverty. But if I give it to him, he will be shamed. I must awake early in the morning before it is dawn and move the landmark which our father has set. With this, he went to sleep, and his sleep was secure and peaceful. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, a long time before it was day, the two brothers met at the ancient landmark. They fell into tears into each other's arms. You see, that's what Jesus hopes. Other places he talks about us using whatever wealth God has given us to bless others with. To create unity, not divide it. You know, there are some people that God just blesses financially. And why does he do that? He does that just out of his graciousness sometimes. But his hope and his desire is that we will be like him. And that we will take what he gives us and use it to create unity, to create relationship, to create opportunities for people to know him and to know us. And yet in the parable in Luke 12, the man never sees that. All he sees is what it means for him and his possessions, my barns and my crops. But then third, God blesses us so that we can bless others. The parable ends with the man's death. So question, what does a dead man own? Nothing. Do you realize the moment you die, you own nothing. Legal, you know, even legally in our country. Then it becomes the property of the estate, subject to the will. And if there's no will, subject to however the state determines how the estate is dispersed. There's a word there that just would not come out. Once you die, you own nothing. But question, what did you do when you gave your life to Christ? Well, one of the things that you did was you were baptized into Christ. Well, question, what is baptism? It's a funeral. In Romans 6, Paul speaks of being buried with Christ in baptism. Okay, it's a funeral. So what happened to everything you owned when you gave your life to Christ, when you died? You died so that Christ could live. You died so that God's Holy Spirit could take residence in your heart. And so if you and I died, what do we own? Absolutely nothing. Nothing that I have is mine. Nothing that you have is yours. It all belongs to God. Now, if we really have that perspective, how differently will we use our checkbook and our credit cards? You know, and God doesn't want us to, you know, and please, I know that that kind of statement has been misused many times. You know, it's not so that somebody can look over our shoulder and say at every purchase we make, would God really want you to buy that? You know, it's not that kind of legalism. But it is a reality and a perspective that this is God's. And you know, sometimes God does want you to use what he's given you just for enjoyment, just for blessing. But it needs to be in perspective. And one part of that perspective that's been very helpful for me through the years is to glean two of the things that Paul says about what we are to do with the money we earn. In fact, the reasons why we earn a living. You know, have you ever asked yourself that? Why do I go to work each week? You know, tomorrow morning, Monday will come, and you will have to answer the question, am I getting up and going to work today? And you'll have to answer the question, first of all, why? Well, for many of us, it's the reality is we get up and go to work in part because we don't know what else to do. But in part because we think, oh, I've got to pay the mortgage, I've got to pay the utilities, and try saving up for, you know, whatever you're saving up for. But do you realize in Scripture that Paul gives us two very specific reasons why we are to work and earn a living? The first one is to provide for ourselves and our family. To provide for our daily needs so that we're not a burden to others. Listen to what Paul says in 1 Timothy 5:8. He says, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for his immediate family, he is denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. You know, God wants us to go out and earn a living and provide for our wives and our children, provide for our families, provide for our aged parents, provide for whoever God has put under our household. That's the first premise. Provide for those that God has placed in your care. And that's a noble reason to go to work each week, each day. But then secondly, the second reason he gives is to give to those who have need. In Ephesians 4:28, he says, he who has been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with those in need. Did you catch that? Look at the end of that. So that he may have something to share. God calls us as a community of believers to come with something to